Good evening, everybody. James McKenna here with my Science Hour for March 10th, 2022. And tonight, interesting show. This is the second in this sequence of the what I call the Cornell years, the two-year period, 1979 fall semester. So September, more or less, 1979 to the spring semester of 1981, which was just a plethora of absolutely rich data, information, coagulation of my theoretical work that I had in place already, and then somewhat of the door being slammed in my face. But what I'm going to do tonight is go through the peer-reviewed publications that I had during those years, and some other publications, and these I'm going to break apart piece by piece. And the reason this is important is because if you go on the internet today, or if you look at other sources of information, or say you go to some of these niddly poops that are running around YouTube pretending they're scientists or whatever, you're going to get a lot of fluff, and primarily fluff. Self-exoneration or things that really are not science, and what I call talky-talky science, about all they do is repeat catchphrases over and over again, but there's no meaning there. So anyway, I want to show you what a real Nobel Prize quality paper looks like. Now, they're not long. A lot of technical papers or published papers are very long, might be the 20 to 30 to 50 pages long in the extreme amount of references, etc. But my papers are very short, and you'll find that, in fact, if you look at, say, Einstein's Nobel Prize paper, is very short, extremely short. But it put the key in the lock, and it turned the key and set a whole new direction for quantum physics. And so it was immediately recognized that that was a paper that was fundamental to understanding the very significant thing on the nature of light, the quantum nature of light, and the wave nature of light, etc. Or if you look at other Nobel Prizes, they might be very short. But it's, like I say, that concept that had to be put, that key that had to be put into the lock that nobody else could turn, that pulling the sword out of the rock, and with a certain, observation, a certain technique also, and an understanding by the author that this is extremely important, and why it's important, and to be succinct. So anyway, I'm going to go through these piece by piece, and then first of all, I'm going to explain a little bit about how these came about. I had a dilemma. I had a dilemma because here I'm sitting on literally a 300-page book that I had written. And at the same time, I had bits and pieces of this book that might be considered distinct, like the plasma discharge comet model or the induced electric dipole redshift, which would be of itself an individual piece. But if you didn't include all of these pieces at one time, people would go, well, it doesn't fit into our structure of physics that we currently know. This is kind of like sitting out in left field all by itself. So I tried both approaches, and clearly either approach has its difficulties. If you try and publish a paper that is a covers-everything paper, people are going to be offended in all respective fields. And so this covers cosmology, comet theory, solar system formation, redshift, general relativity, things that were believed to be well established. And so someplace somebody's going to say, well, it contradicts things that we generally accept. And so for that reason, the paper as a whole, even though it covers all of these very important topics and gives a completely new structure for much of astrophysics and astronomy and space science, would be a difficult one for the publication peer review system to swallow. So the other technique is to pick apart a topic at a time. And so that's what I chose to do. And also remember, I was being I had a little help from a friend of mine. His name was Hans Bethe. And I went to him and I talked to him about my dilemma. And so anyway, I was having trouble being published in the U.S. journals because, it's like a cloistered religion. And so he said, here, I'll give you the name of an editor that he was familiar with in Europe, Denik Kopal. And Denik Kopal was editor-in-chief of a number of major astrophysics journals. And so the very first one, Astrophysics and Space Science, is where my Galaxy article was published. And it was a way of getting into the publication arena with something that was very fundamental, and that is the formation of galaxies. And out of that, there were some very instrumental results. And one was the formation of twin stars. When you look up into the sky, when you look into the heavens through a telescope and you start seeing stars and their companions, and you can see the companions not always visible, but you see the main star moving back and forth over a time period of, like, say, for Jupiter, if somebody were looking at our sun from a distance and say they couldn't see Jupiter physically, they would see our sun wobbling back and forth on about a 5-year period, moving one way, then back, because Jupiter's orbit is about 10 years long. And so they would know that that's a twin star, but they could also tell that there was not a third significant star, that it was a twin star system. And so if you look up in the sky, you see that about 75% of the stars are in twin star systems, and the other 25% are in higher order, but three star systems. But the thing about those is that two of the stars are close together, so they appear to be almost like one star from the distant third star. They might be the third star orbiting the main star, or they might be two major stars orbiting closely with one third star out in the distance, causing those two to wobble back and forth. So, but still, it technically is a twin star system. The Russians had done a good deal of statistical work on solar system formation, and what they realized was that this concept, what they call the Lagrangian formation of solar systems, where it forms from a swirling ball of dust and gas, and this goes back to the Middle Ages, really, and never really worked. I mean, it had all kinds of problems. The planets spin backwards of what you observe, so then something has to come in and hit them all just correctly to make them spin forward. All kinds of topsy-turvy explanations that really didn't work. Not to mention the fact that you see dust clouds in space all the time and they're not collapsing to form stars. There's other stellar formation processes going on. So anyway, I had to combine these reality checks into the paper, and also into that paper, one of the results of my Galaxy paper was that it explained why there are majority twin star systems. And also it explained the symmetry in galactic arms. And this is one of the big problems that was around for a long time. And the experts knew this, but the people running around looking for missing mass because of the light curves in the galactic arms, this was the red shift and the blue shift taken from galactic arms, was not Newtonian gravitational consistent. They were very strange, and they assumed incorrectly that the stars were going in circular orbits around the nucleus. So I dispelled that also, and I showed how gravitational, normal Newtonian gravitation explains the light curves in the arms of the galaxy. And also then there was a third thing. At the time, there was a scientist named Weber who was one of the very first pioneers dealing with gravity waves. And he was detecting at about one gravity wave per day coming from the central part of our galactic nucleus, the Milky Way galactic nucleus. And my paper explained those. And so in all, this paper literally was a very short paper but a Nobel Prize winning quality paper. And the Danik Kopal, who, like I say, Hans Bethe, who was resident at Cornell, himself a Nobel Prize winner for stellar physics, and of course worked on the stellar core model and things like that. But he also knew there were some issues, and that's one of the things that I talked to him about, because we needed some other model for solar fusion. And that's something that I had worked on, and that was one of the future papers to come out, and actually comes out in the second paper on Saturn in a very subtle way. And so what I'm about to describe here is kind of like playing a chess game with the astrophysics journals, getting a paper published that not everybody realizes what it is when it first comes out. And the other thing about the Galaxy paper, which is the first peer-reviewed published paper that I had when I was at Cornell, is that it developed a new mathematical technique using differential calculus to calculate the shape of the arms for all time. And so this is something that nobody else really thought about. And so when Danik Kopal saw this paper come in to his desk, I sent it there. And then that's back in the days when there were no electronic databases or email or electronic transfers. This was typed up by the secretary, Marie Jones, who was the secretary in the physics department. I talked about her previously, and was sent in by mail. So this had to cross the pond. This had to get over to England to Danik Kopal's office. And when he saw it, he took it upon himself to referee it himself and publish it immediately, because he realized the importance of this paper. And so anyway, that first paper was very high quality. And then I'm going to describe the second paper, which is called Saturn Sweeper Moons Predicted, which prior to the spacecraft getting to Saturn, noticed some anomalies in the ring patterns of Saturn. And once again, there I'm able to slip in the idea that Saturn and Jupiter are stars. They're fusion-based stars with hydrogen winds. In other words, ionized hydrogen is a proton, basically. So that had proton winds and a capacitor, which was the lead-in, by the way. This is how I was leading in to talk about comets, the plasma discharge comet model, in a paper that was subtly talking about the rings of Saturn. And so you'll see that these were very skillfully done. And the information that I put in there is very important, because it talks about the induced electric dipole redshift, which I'm putting in there as an effect on spacecraft. And so there again, the whole issue of spacecraft charging comes along, because early pioneers in the field of spacecraft realized that we were talking about 10 to 20,000 volt charges on a spacecraft. And so and I'll just insert a little bit here. There are some, all throughout the history of the space program, a lot of scientists dabbled in this issue of spacecraft charging. And believe me, they have no idea what they're talking about, or the scale or the magnitude or the effects that actually happen. And let me just fast forward here. I was a guest on the Coast to Coast AM radio show back in the mid-2000s, something like that. I was invited to defend Velikovsky's theories, etc., and the whole issue of Velikovsky with a NASA scientist, which turned out to be Dr. David Morrison, who was a student of Carl Sagan, one of Sagan's very favorite students, and who became a NASA scientist and head of the search for near-Earth objects, the near-Earth object research arm of NASA. Dr. Morrison was the head of that, so highly respected. And so at any rate, during the debate, I brought up the fact that you cannot measure voltages in outer space with a single spacecraft is absolutely impossible, because a voltage, by definition, is a potential difference. So you have to have two physical points, and you cannot do that with a single spacecraft. And so, and then it comes to the issue of spacecraft charging. And so here was a top NASA scientist who did not understand this. And it came out on the air, and I was on a radio show just the other day as a guest, and a caller called in and recounted that incident on the radio, where I nailed this guy on the radio, exposing him as not understanding an issue of spacecraft charging or what it's all about. Not only spacecraft charging, but the fact that you cannot measure spacecraft voltages with a single spacecraft. And that, in fact, if you have a spacecraft, you will always measure equal numbers of positive and negative charges at the detectors because of the way the charging occurs. And so anyway, it's an impossible feat. It's simply not possible. And you still find people running around thinking that they're somehow able to do this. And so at any rate, there are techniques for understanding how to do this. But it's because of the nature of education today, all the way up to the PhD level and beyond, the people in science simply don't understand this. And I would add, too, that the idiots running around on YouTube channels don't understand it either. So anyway, going back to now, here I am. This is 1979. I'm at Cornell. I've just been told I'm not able to use Cornell's name to publish papers, and so I have to comply with this. And so it's in the January time frame that I move into the mathematics department. So you're going to see on my papers, J.M. McCanney, Department of Mathematics, Cornell University. And the first one, the Galaxy paper, is received on May 2nd, 1980. And so remember that this paper has to be typed and sent via mail. So it has to go over the pond by mail and then be registered and then accepted. So it was received, stamped on May 2nd, 1980, the Galaxy paper. And then the other paper, the Saturn Moons, Sweeper Moons Predicted, was in October of 1980. So now I'm in my second year of fall semester. But the thing is that that paper, the Saturn paper, was first submitted to Icarus, which was the Cornell Space Science Journal. Carl Sagan was the editor of that, but he was on a trip becoming a movie star with the Cosmos series. So his attaché, a guy named Joe Burns, was editor of that paper, and he wrote back a very terse, short letter saying there's no need to assume electric fields around Saturn, that the Saturnian rings were a remnant of the original solar system 4.5 billion years ago, and there was no need to assume anything like sweeper moons could exist. I'll just put in a caveat here. Joe Burns, then, after rejecting my paper, which I turned around and sent off to the European journals for the advice of Hans Bethe, Joe Burns turns around and steals my work, including the title, and becomes the NASA expert on sweeper moons after, I might add, they were discovered. So I predicted them before they were discovered. Very amazing, because nobody in their wildest dreams imagined that Saturn's rings harbored small moons. And so anyway, I'll go through the details of that paper, but once again, I talk about Saturn being a small star with a proton wind. And there are the subtleties of moving this in there. And then I talk about Jupiter also being a small star and using the plasma discharge comet model as the mechanism for the ring fading that was observed throughout history at Saturn, and predicting the exact orbits of these small moons, which were not visible from Earth. At the time, all of the best telescopes at Earth were, these moons were under that about 200-mile diameter limit. Okay, so at any rate, here we go. Let's jump into these papers. And The reason I'm going through a lot of detail here is because you're going to see what a real scientific paper looks like and the details and why when Zdeněk Kopal received this paper and immediately published it in Astrophysics and Space Science. But also additionally, what you will find out is that the people who then came back and criticized this and wanted me to be fired from the mathematics department as well, this came from astronomers and space scientists, primarily from Cornell University and other places, because by this time they had sent out the message, do not publish anything from this guy named McCanny. And it's called blackballing. That's the industry term. But at any rate, the odd thing here is that those people, the space scientists and astronomers, typically have very poor math background, very poor physics background. The only thing they knew is it disagreed with what they propounded. And so that was sufficient to have a negative verdict on what I was publishing. They had no idea of the mathematical techniques that I had developed for the galaxy paper, which was to take differential equations, put them together, and remove time so that you have an equation for the shape of the arm for all time. This is something nobody had ever seen before. This is like a 20-move chess game against Bobby Fischer. This is the mathematical equivalent of something like that. Very subtle. And then all of the other details woven into this, including the explanation for the symmetry in galaxies using a 3-dimension fluid flow problem. And so anyway, this included so many details that were spot on. And in fact, let me explain also that one of the great difficulties in understanding galactic structure is the tremendous symmetry. If you take any galactic picture, whether it's a warped galaxy or a bar galaxy or any other type, and I talk about these, by the way, in my university level astronomy, astrophysics, and space science course. And I give a lot of examples because galaxies have tremendous symmetry. If you go out in one direction from a nucleus of a galaxy, and then you go out the same distance in the opposite direction, if there's a star cluster there, there will be on the other side. If there's a gaping hole there, there will be on the other side. If there's a bend or a warpage in the galactic plane, it'll be on the other side. The symmetry is amazing, amazing on all galaxies, unless there was something that affected one side, like, say, the location of a nearby quasar. But the symmetry was something that people ignored, and then this missing mass group, Ed Salpeter and crew, they just completely ignored the whole issue of symmetry that had to be explained, had to be an integral part of any theory for galactic formation. So anyway, my work explained symmetry to the T exactly perfectly and with a 3-dimension fluid flow problem around a galactic nucleus, etc. And it explained the angular momentum, the light curves, the fact that there are twin stars in the galaxies, all of these things, and the reason for approximately one gravitational wave coming out of the galactic nucleus as measured by Weber. All of these things in one short little paper. And so anyway, the point I was making is that this is trying to be negated by people who don't even understand any of this, these subtleties, the mathematical acuteness in these papers, etc. And all they know is it disagreed with what they were trying to promote in the physical journals. That's all they knew. And so that's why they were against it. Not because of what it said. In fact, in most cases, I guarantee you, they didn't even understand what it said. And these same problems continue today in the scientific world, especially astronomy, astrophysics, and space science. Okay, on now to the first paper, Continuing Galactic Formation, and going through in detail. I should add one more comment here and understand that when I'm reading this paper, this is the paper that will get the plasma discharge comet model into publication. That's the plan. This is the paper that'll set the stage for the capture process of solar system formation, because with twin stars, you only have two stars, one smaller one typically orbiting a bigger one, or two smaller ones orbiting a bigger one, or one of those scenarios of a twin star system. But everything else had to come later. So this is setting the stage for everything that would come later with the plasma discharge comet model, the capture processes in the formation of solar systems, the solar capacitor, the fusion base in activity in the atmosphere, not in the core, and on and on and on. And you'll see also in the Saturn paper where I'm moving in the principles, the fundamental principles that are necessary for the plasma discharge comet model and the formation of solar system and comets becoming planets, etc., etc. And you'll see also in these early papers I reference TJJC, and you'll see that in the Saturn paper. Okay, so anyway, what I'm doing here is setting the groundwork for the oncoming papers, which, of course, got slam dunked because Carl and the boys came over and had me removed before any of those could come out. But then they eventually did come out in later publications. But I'll also go through those papers to talk about where this is going. But okay, on to the Galaxy paper. Now let me pull this up. Okay, now by the way, this is an appendix one of my Planet X Comets and Earth Changes book. So if you have that book, and if you don't, you better have it. But in the appendix is this paper, and it's J.M. McCanney, Department of Mathematics, Cornell University, Ithaca, New York, USA, received May 2nd, 1980. It says, abstract, a new theory for galactic arm formation shows that the arms to be continually emanating from the galactic nucleus due to a continual influx of cosmic dust. So this presents a very different model than the dust cloud swirling and swirling in circular orbits like a record disc around the nucleus. This is a dust flow that becomes a fluid flow problem in three dimensions. And so, once again, something that nobody had done before. But as the dust falls inward, it starts to transfer its angular momentum into faster and faster rotation. And so this is something like the skater, you know, the figure skater at the Olympics. When they pull their arms in, they rotate faster. And it's the same thing with this dust cloud in the galactic nucleus. And physicists would understand this, that this is a angular momentum, conservation of angular momentum problem in fluid flow. And then it says, okay, in the neighborhood of the galactic nucleus, the problem is treated as a fluid flow, and a simple solution is given using conservation of momentum. When rotational dynamics are included, the spinning arm system is the result. This solution resolves the problem of the missing mass. Okay, stop. This is key, because this problem had haunted astrophysics since galaxies were first, the light curves on the galactic arms were first discovered. And so anyway, they don't match gravitational systems. So resolving the missing mass problem was crucial and very important. Okay, and then I read on. Accounts for warp disk galaxies and gives a probable source for the gravity waves measured by Weber, which emanate from our galactic center. Okay, here in a couple sentences are probably three Nobel Prize winning conclusions from this one paper. Okay, then it says, reversal of arm direction is demonstrated and examples of such reversals are cited. So once again, these are observations. Arm reversal is an observation of galactic phenomenon, where the arms are going in one direction and all of a sudden they start going in the other direction. and also barred galaxies, etc., other different formations besides your typical spiral galaxy. Then it says, reversal of arm direction is demonstrated and examples are cited. An approximate theoretical estimate of the age of our sun is found to be in good agreement with radioisotope dating. So dating our sun. Our sun was formed near the galactic nucleus. It was thrown out in this fluid flow problem. And the age of the model that I'm developing here, the mathematical model, agrees with the isotope dating of the sun. And so the sun didn't form all by itself with all the planets around it. No, it formed with a companion. Okay, reading on. A general result shows why twin star systems are in such great abundance in a galaxy. There is the core issue. Do you see right there? I'm paving the way for the plasma discharge comet model and the capture system of twin star systems capturing comets that become planets. I'm setting the stage in that one sentence. Well, I'll read it again here. A general result shows why twin star systems are in such abundance in the galaxy. Then it reads on, it gives a model of galactic evolution, which begins with only a single massive nucleus with the collapsing gas clouds forming the arms. Okay, so that's the abstract. And you can see what I'm doing here. I'm setting the stage for capture processes in the formation of the solar system with comets. And then also, as you can see in my very early papers, I use pictures of star systems that are nebular ion clouds around other stars where you can see the comets forming. You can see the comets forming planets. Okay, so I'm just going to go through this paper, and I'm going to take my time. I'm not going to rush through these because there's a lot of material to cover here, but I'm going to pick it apart line by line. So galactic arm formation. So the very initial problem is setting the stage for this fluid flow problem. So I have figure one illustrates the homogeneous cloud of cosmic dust and gases as it collapses around the hemisphere, which resembles a half model of the galactic nucleus. Okay, now, interestingly enough, here I'm using a half model. In boat building, which is something I did, you typically, when you do a design of a boat, you build a half model. That's half of the boat. If you cut the boat from bow to stern down the middle, and it's perfectly symmetric. You don't have an asymmetrical boat where one side is different than the other. So to build the boat, a model, you build a half model. And that's what I did with the galaxy. So some of my experience with boat building and scaling comes into play here. Okay, the reading on here. The matter is considered to be in a fluid state in the vicinity of the nucleus. So this collapsing dust cloud comes in and it gets so hot that it's in a fluid plasma state. The viscosity between the fluid and the nucleus is neglected at this point, but evidence will be presented later that indicates that the angular momentum of the nucleus is instrumental in maintaining the galactic plane. Okay, so how do you maintain when this fluid material flows in and it comes out? How does it maintain the galactic plane? Part of it is in the conservation of angular momentum in the fluid flow, and part of it is in the nucleus of the galaxy itself. The fluid flow problem is divided into three distinct areas: cloud influx, fluid flow in the vicinity of the nucleus, and a shotgun effect as the matter is sprayed outwards from the nucleus and condenses into new stars. The analysis of the shotgun effect in producing many stars in an infinite variety of sizes will show why twin stars are in such abundance. The hot stellar matter sprays outward in Keplerian elliptical orbits. Now, what is Keplerian? Keplerian is Newtonian gravity. And this is not electrical, it's not magnetic. It's Keplerian elliptical orbits. So anyway, this is somewhat of a mouthful, but basically what it's saying is that gravity is the force that controls the shape of the galaxy. And you have the symmetry, you have the twin star systems, you have the fluid flow. And now I'm going to talk about why there are two arms. Now, that's a problem, because if you have a fluid flow problem, why are there two arms? Why are there only two arms on the galaxy? Why are there not three or four or five or six or ten? Why are there only two? And it comes down to, again, conservation of momentum and energy and part of a fluid flow problem. Okay, so you have the fluid flowing in, it's compressing, it's twisting around the nucleus. And so what's going to happen? This pressure builds up, and so the material on the inside is going to have a higher pressure than the outside, and the arms are going to, the fluid flow is going to come out in one column. Now, and that's on one side. This is, remember, this is a half model of the galaxy. Why does one arm come out and not two or three or four coming out the side of the galaxy? And the reason is, I'll read it the way the paper explains it here. Due to the back pressure caused by the constant inflow of matter, a single outflowing arm of circular cross-section will result, which moves perpendicular to the base of the hemisphere. This circular cross-section allows the least amount of surface area between the inflow and the outflow, in other words, the lowest surface viscosity. Physical systems always take the route of lowest energy. They don't go to a higher energy state because they're limited to moving at the lower energy state, simply the way the physical systems work. The same quantity must flow out as flows inward. It can easily be shown that if two outflowing arms resulted, the resistive viscosity between the two arms and the inflow would be the square root of two times greater than the case of one flow. In other words, you have 1.414 times as much resistance if you have two arms coming out than if you have one arm coming out the side of the galaxies. And so anyway, that in a nutshell explains why there's two arms coming out the galaxy, one coming out of each side. But why are they always opposite of each other? This is another issue of conservation of momentum, conservation of energy, and a fluid flow problem in three dimensions. Like I say, something nobody had ever done before. Here I'll read on. In a general, total viscosity is proportional to the square root of n, where n is the number of outflows. So as the number of n of outflows becomes larger, the resistance, the total viscosity resistance, becomes proportionately larger. And then I read on, the arm will choose the path of least resistance. Therefore, a single arm of circular cross-section is forced out of the galactic nucleus. It will be perpendicular to the plane of the base of the hemisphere. As a thin hemispherical shell of dust falls into the hemisphere, the galactic nucleus will be forced to recoil perpendicular to the base of the hemisphere using conservation of momentum. Thus, the arm must emanate in the opposite direction, being also perpendicular to the base of the hemisphere. I'm talking about the half model. Putting two hemispheres together gives a model for the arm-generating process. In the real galaxy, the faint gas dust clouds, which are continually falling inwards, are not homogeneous and will fall into the nucleus with a certain angular momentum, thus defining the plane of the galaxy. This is the cause of the spinning arm system. The matter in the arm is thrown outwards in elliptical orbits with high eccentricity. The total energy is designated by initial conditions. This article assumes the following parameters, but they are not meant to typify any particular galaxy. Okay, and so I go on. Okay, so in that brief introduction, what I do is explain why there are two arms coming out of the side of the galaxy and why are the arms in the opposite directions. All of this is because of a three-dimensional fluid flow problem, which I work out here, and then it starts talking about the mathematics. Okay, so Then what I do is I go through a mathematical discussion of the elliptical orbits of the stars. And when you look at the path of these stars and their radial component, in other words, the radial velocity around the galactic nucleus, what you get is the light curve that has been measured for galactic arms. So you don't have to include missing mass in the galaxy to explain the light curves. It is explained by the model. And so anyway, there again, it explains something that has been a thorn in the side of the astronomical astrophysics community, these light curves, which don't match Newtonian physics. And where do they come from? Well, if you assume that the star systems are going around the nucleus of the galaxy in circular orbits, then the light curves don't make any sense at all. But if you use the model that I just stated, they fit the model, the actual physical readings, perfectly. And so clearly that's the way these galaxy arms are formed. And it also explains the symmetry, because if you have a big influx all of a sudden of material falling in towards the galactic nucleus, then you will have a lot of star systems coming out the arms. If you have a dearth or lack of material coming into the nucleus region, then you will have voids in the arms that result from those arms that are being sprayed out away from the galactic nucleus. If there's a change in angular momentum, in other words, the axis that is perpendicular to the plane of angular momentum, if that changes, then that will warp the galaxy. And that warpage will extend out into space, into the arms, and you will observe a warped galaxy. All of this is explained by this very simple little model. But as I said, it's setting the stage for all of a sudden now you explain why there are two stars in twin star systems, or this unusual, less popular formation where you have three stars in a twin star-like state, where two of the stars are close together and the other star is far away. So the two stars together look as one star, more or less, to the third star. And so basically you almost have a twin star system. So all of the twin star systems are very well explained by this model. And then the twin star system also, this is something that if you understand about celestial mechanics, which most astronomers do not, is that the capture process requires two bodies. A single star all by itself, or a single physical massive object all by itself, will not be able to capture an object coming by in its gravitational field. What happens when you have two gravitational bodies? That's when, through rotational dynamics, you can have a third object coming in become captured. The reverse process is many times used in spacecraft flight, where they'll take a spacecraft and they'll swing it by one of the planets in the opposite mode, where the spacecraft gains energy, it gains momentum, and it gains a lot of velocity. So it's a way of using, it's called a gravitational assist, to throw a spacecraft out at a much higher velocity than you would get if you had just a propulsion system doing it. But the reverse of that is called capture. In other words, you can bring a spacecraft in, if you do it just right, come around a planet, and that spacecraft will lose energy and drop into a lower orbit. Or if it's a comet coming in, that's a large comet, and it's gaining matter and it's becoming a planet, it can be captured and dropped into a lower orbit. And then using the tail drag, which is something else, and I'm, by the way, I'm referring to TJJC's work on the secular action of the resistance medium, the resisting medium, which is a book that I found in Cornell in the stacks that had not been touched in over probably 80 years. It had been there on the shelf because Cornell was a Library of Congress, but because in my diligence I was going through all of the texts, this massive article talking about the process of resistance median on capture processes in the formation of solar systems. But the problem was that the work by TJJC, they found out that there was no significant resisting medium and resistance medium in outer space. So it fell by the wayside. But when I came along and I said, well, it's the tail drag that's coming in, it's being pulled in by the negative charge around the comet nucleus, and that drag of the tail is the equivalent of dragging all of this material from around the solar system like a big vacuum cleaner into the nucleus, and that tail drag then brings the comet into a much smaller orbit and circularizes the orbit. So that's the process by which comets become planets. And so it has to be a relatively large comet because the gravitational field is significant and can, once this material comes in, it maintains it, whereas the little comets, typically the material comes in, it becomes neutralized, and then those ions, those neutralized ions, go flowing out in the solar wind, and the little comets really don't gain a lot of matter. But the bigger comets do, because gravity works in coordination with the electric fields to pick up the matter and keep it at the comet nucleus, thusly changing its orbit. And we saw that with Comet Halbach, where Comet Halbach in the mid-1990s was changing its orbit on a daily basis. And the jokers at Brian Marsden and the other jokers at the Smithsonian and NASA scientists couldn't figure out why this was happening, so they just pretended it wasn't happening. So I'll be talking more about those issues in the future. But back to the galaxy paper, you can see what I'm doing here is setting the stage for the plasma discharge comet model, the capture processes in solar systems, etc., because of the twin star systems that I talk about and develop in the galaxy paper. Okay, now I'm going to jump ahead a little bit in this paper because this goes through a lot of rather technical arguments, but I'm going to go to the second to the last and the last paragraph before the conclusion. I want to read these to understand, and you, once again, I'm putting this paper into perspective relative to what is coming later, and I had to do this, like I said in the beginning, I had to do this because I had to set the stage for what was about to come in other papers. So here I'm reading from the last couple paragraphs of the paper. A number of difficulties arise in presently accepted theories of solar system evolution which are not compatible with this concept of galactic evolution. One is that an entire solar system of 9 planets and over 30 moons is not the result of a solitary gas cloud evolving on its own, but in fact, no more than the Sun and Jupiter could have been in the original star system. Okay, I'm going to stop here for a second because I put the stars, the Sun and Jupiter, I'm stating here that Jupiter is a star. It's the twin star of the Sun. So I'm getting away from this idea that Jupiter is a planet, something a totally radical idea in this time frame, because the spacecraft really had not examined Jupiter yet, but I'm saying, no, it's a star. And it shows star-like characteristics and fusion-like characteristics. Okay, so back to reading. The other 40 bodies could only have been the object of subsequent captures by this twin star system. So I'm stating right here that capture is the mechanism for solar system formation. Reading on. Secondly, there is no chance that comets made from condensed ices could form in the heated environment of the galactic nucleus. Do you see where this is going? Yes, I'm stating right here that comets are not dirty snowballs, nor could they be any part of the original solar system. Reading on. It is generally accepted in the plasma theories of solar system evolution. These are the ones where the dust cloud collapses into circular orbits and all the planets are there, etc. It says, it is generally accepted in the plasma theories of solar system evolution that the comets were an original part of the solar system. Two possibilities exist. Comets were not an original part of the solar system, or comets are not ice balls, or both. So what I do is I take the Dirty Snowball Comet model and I put it on a stretcher and put nails in it. Now imagine the horror that this is bringing to the astronomy department and Carl Sagan at Cornell, that I am taking data that they're bringing back from space probes and I'm putting it into articles and telling them that everything they're doing is wrong. Their cosmology is wrong, their solar system development is wrong, and okay, now read the last paragraph. I have proposed a complete theory for comet behavior and solar system evolution based on a new model for the comet, which shows it to be a hot radioactive nuclear conglomerate. These papers were not accepted for publication as they did not fit into the accepted theoretical scheme of solar system evolution. This paper lays a firmer foundation for those papers. So I'm setting the stage. Okay, then the conclusion. A new model for galactic evolution was given, which predicts the spiral arm shape. Stars are found to be in highly elliptical orbits after being thrown out of the nucleus. The theory correlates heretofore anomalous data and answers the question of where is the missing mass. There is no missing mass. That's my side note here, just a comment. The last sentence states, the most important result is that presently accepted theories of solar system evolution are not compatible with this model. So imagine the horror of the astronomy, the astrophysics, and the space science department reading this in a published paper and their reaction to it. And so anyway, I want to also mention in here that I have referenced a number of papers. One was by Ed Saltpeter. Now, I mentioned him before, and he is a Cornell researcher. I don't think Ed taught classes. He may have had some grad students there. But he was a big proponent of the missing mass. And when I would encounter him and talk to him, one day, I'll never just remember this one, I saw him walking in the hall. And he was a very proper, rather elderly gentleman at the time. And so the I said, Ed, you know, I've developed this theoretical model for the development of galaxies that shows that there's no need for missing mass. And he said, I favor the missing mass proposal. And he turned on his heels and walked straight away and wouldn't talk about it. But, you know, this was the attitude. This was the nose-in-the-air attitude. And, of course, it was threatening. It was threatening their way of life. This is affecting their lifelong work. So I can see why it would be threatening, but I'm not interested in, I was not trying to do anything threatening. I was just talking to him and presenting a model which did not require the missing mass in the galactic structure. And the whole problem with missing mass is, where did it come from? You can't see it. There's no disk of missing mass that's visible. It supposedly has gravitational properties, but when you have large quantities of gravitational material, it collapses into stars and forms stars. So how do you have all this massive material, the missing mass, that's supposedly there but you can't see? It doesn't stop light from passing through. It has all of these strange properties, and they're still dealing with that. They're wrestling with that same alligator today in modern science, the so-called dark matter and dark energy. They're still searching for it, and it's because of the models for galactic evolution don't work. And I solved this in this paper published in 1980. But anyway, these discussions are carrying on. And I want to mention, too, that Nobel Prizes have been given recently, in recent years, for people who worked with some of the old early discoverers of gravitational waves, Weber being one of them. And so when I talk about Nobel Prize, this paper predated all of the theoretical discussions for why there should be gravitational waves coming out of the vicinity of the gravity of the galactic nucleus. And so, you know, these are things that should have been noticed and should have been recognized, but weren't. Okay, I could go quite a few other aspects of the galaxy paper, but I'm going to move on to the Saturn sweeper moons paper, the Saturn sweeper moons predicted paper, but I'm running out of time here, so I'll just give it a brief introduction and then next week pick up on the same topic. But these papers are so important because of the time frame. If you can imagine 1979-1980 time frame when I was projecting this, nobody had a clue. Nobody had even the most remote idea of where I was going. So I came out with solutions that were so far advanced in the day that people just, they simply were not able to accept them because they were just so stuck on these old models. Okay, so now moving on to the Saturn sweeper moons predicted paper. This is once again, Saturn sweeper moons predicted. This was published in a journal called The Moon and the Planets. The previous galaxy article was published in Astrophysics and Space Science, another journal, astrophysics journal. And I'll just read the abstract quickly here for the Saturn moon paper. The recent observation of the absorption of radiation belts in the vicinity of Saturn's bright rings and historical observations of the ring system make the following related results apparent. The gaps in the rings are caused by the presence of at least six small, extremely dense, and probably electrically charged sweeper moons. Okay, I'm going to stop there because you can see right out of the gate, I'm talking about the electrically charged sweeper moons. So I'm getting that in right in the beginning. And so it's very important to understand that's what the Saturn paper was about, and I call Saturn a small star. I talk about the hydrogen wind coming off of Saturn and the capacitor. This is where I lay down the whole concept of the proton wind-supported capacitor. All of these concepts will come out in the Saturn papers, which I'll start with next week. But also that the material being drawn into the comet nucleus is being drawn into the comet nucleus. That's what causes the Saturn ring fading that's going on, is that the material is moving towards the nucleus. So that's established in this paper also. But very important now, like I say, understand the time frame. This is 1979. This is before anybody had a clue of what's going on around these planets. And that's why it was so important for me to be at Cornell, because the data was just flowing in and confirming my predictions, my theoretical work, etc. So once again, be sure to visit my webpage, jmccsci.com, the Water Filters webpage, jmccwaterfilters.com, and as always, a 10% discount if you use the coupon code JMCC. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.